The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 242.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He's my good buddy down in Puerto Rico. He needs no introduction. His name is Peter Schiff. Peter, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Oh, thanks, George, for having me back on. Too bad you can't be here in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, we were supposed to do this at your house.
Yeah, I know. We're happy to have you.
Well, hey, I've really enjoyed your podcast recently. I'm listening to every episode I can. And I just actually wrote down some things that you've referenced in some of your past videos and podcast episodes that I'd love for you to address with my crowd in case they missed it. And the one thing is the nuanced difference between consumer behavior between deflation and inflation. You know, the Keynesians want us to believe that if there's any deflation, then everyone will completely stop buying everything. They won't buy gas. They won't buy health insurance. They won't pay their rent until, you know, they see the prices settling because they want to get a better deal. But you point out how that's complete nonsense. But then you also point out how inflation might get people to start buying more often because there's like have an opposite effect. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, first of all, when consumers expect prices to fall, what they don't do is buy things in advance of actually needing them. And the same is true with businesses and whether or not they want to carry big inventories, right? If you're a businessman and you think the price of the goods that you're buying is likely to be lower in the future than today, then why would you want to hold a bunch of inventory? Because the inventory is going to be losing value while it's in your possession. You might as well wait until the future when you actually think you're going to need the inventory to sell. And that's kind of how this just-in-time inventory really got popular, because right, there was no real pressure on companies to invest in a lot of inventory if they knew they could just buy it when they needed at the same price or lower. But consumers buy things when they need them. So, for example, you know, if I need a new cell phone today, because my cell phone, maybe the screen is cracked or, you know, it's just not working well. Even though I think that if I wait another 6 months or another year, it could be $20 cheaper. Am I really going to suffer through that year to try to save those $20? Or am I going to assign a value to having the new phone today,
right,
and not having to suffer through, you know, my cracked screen for another year? So I'm just going to buy. You know, and the proof that falling prices don't deter people from buying things that they want is consumer electronics, televisions, computers, cell phones. Everybody knows if they just wait, they'll be able to buy it cheaper. But you don't want to wait. You want it now. You want to use it. And right, so the only thing that you won't buy if you expect prices to fall is stuff that you don't really need. So I'm not going to stock up on, you know, the toothpaste that I think I might need in a year. I mean, I'll just buy that when I need it. I mean, what's the point? There's only so much room in my medicine cabinet for these types of things. But what changes when consumers expect prices to rise is they start to stock up on things that they don't really need today, mm-hmm, but they know they're going to need in the future. But rather than waiting for the future and then buying those items at a higher price, if they have some extra cash, they might as well buy them now rather than wait until they're more expensive. So you will start to see this psychology changing where when people go to the store, they don't just buy what they need for the week or what they need for the month. They're going to buy what they need for the year.
Right.
You know, and not only if they expect the price to go up, but what if they're worried that there may not be a big supply of the particular items that they want? You might as well stock up on those things now, because not only may the prices be higher in the future, there may not be any inventory in the future, because other people start hoarding those goods because they expect the price to be higher. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But the same thing with companies. Now companies see the raw materials that they need or their inventory,
lumber,
progressively getting higher and higher. So now the businesses know, I better stock up on my inventory now. I just can't wait because everything keeps getting more and more expensive. So instead of holding cash, I'm going to hold products, merchandise. And so now everybody wants to start buying stuff and getting rid of their paper. And then that's when the velocity of the money really picks up and you really start to see prices spiraling out of control.
Yeah, and we're seeing that with used car prices. We're seeing that with what I've noticed when you look at the detail of the CPI is stuff that people buy daily, that's really going up. Stuff that people buy maybe once every 6 months, like clothing or like an airline ticket, that's going down. But the stuff that people buy daily, that's where we're really seeing those big price increases. So another thing that you discussed, I think in yesterday's podcast, was the new CPI print and how that just blew it out of the water. Can you go over that?
Yeah, and I don't know why people were so surprised by the big increase. I mean, if you look at the first 3 months of the year, we printed 0.3 in January, then 0.4 in February, and then 0.6 in March. So, you know, 3 months in a row of increasing CPI, why they expected it to crash all the way back down to 0.2,
right.
But, you know, it just continued in the same progression and we went to 0.8. And the interesting thing is, forgetting about the 4.2% year over year number, look at the year to date number. Prices are already up by 2% on the year and we're only a third of the way through it. And we've already hit the Fed's target for a whole year. So if the next 8 months are the same as the first four, we're at 6%, which is triple the Fed's 2% target. But I don't know why it would only be 6%, because that would assume that we stop the progression that's already in place. Right. So if you assume that this trend that's in motion is going to stay in motion for the rest of the year, I mean, you're looking at double-digit inflation as measured by the CPI for 2021. Now, then what is the Fed going to do about that in 2022? Well, nothing. They're so far behind the curve, it's impossible to catch up. Because if the Fed is going to try to fight inflation with monetary policy, and if it waits until inflation is 10%, it's not like it's going to move interest rates from zero to a quarter of a point, right, or a half a point or even 1 point. That's not going to do anything to derail that inflation train. The Fed is going to have to get out in front of it, and they're going to have to bring rates up, you know, to 12% or 14%. I mean, Powell's going to have to go Paul Volcker on the market.
Yeah.
Well, you can't do that with all the debt that we have. I mean, they didn't have all the debt back in 1980. You know, the government had the whole national debt financed with 30-year treasuries. So, you know, a big increase in interest rates didn't really impact the government's ability to service its debt. But if Powell had to fight inflation today, the U.S. government would have to default on its debt.
Because they have to roll over such a high percentage of the total debt.
Yeah, and they can't afford it. I mean, something like a third of the debt comes due in the next year.
Yeah,
and
right.
If that paper is right now financed at 25 basis points and they have to roll it over at 10%, you know, you're talking about 40 times the interest expense. And of course, all this would be done in a recession, because if the Fed starts raising interest rates to fight inflation, well, we're going to get a recession. I mean, everybody is all levered up. And not only does, you know, the Democrats have to cancel all their stimulus plans,
right,
they have to take back the stimulus they've already supplied. Without the Fed monetizing the debts, you can't have the debts. So now the government has to start cutting spending. But I think in the recession, their tax revenue is going to be depleted at the same time that their interest expense is soaring.
Yeah.
Their total
expenses are soaring because consumer inflation is going up. Therefore, the government's expenses go up as well.
Right. They have to give the people on Social Security a raise. And, of course, fewer people are paying taxes to fund Social Security. But now the cost is going higher because of the COLAs. But look, you know, this is a catch 22, right? The Fed's damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. There's nothing that it can do in this situation. Like I pointed out today, again, I was on Fox Business with Liz Claman, but the idea is that, well, you know, the Fed keeps saying we have the tools to fight inflation. Yeah, they do have the tools, but they can't use them. Right? Right. If your only tool to cure your headache is a handgun, right, are you really going to pull the trigger?
Right.
I mean, so they can't kill the economy in order to cure inflation. So they're not even going to try, which means inflation is going to run out of control.
I remember you saying a long time ago when we started QE1 that we were going into a monetary roach motel. So do you think that we're now not only in a QE roach motel, but we're in a stimulus roach motel as well?
Well, it's the same motel, you know. And, you know, I hear some people, you know, will come on the, you know, television, you know, the financial channels, and they'll say, well, you know, yeah, the Fed is too easy now. They've kept their foot on the gas too long. They'll say they were right to do the stimulus, you know, initially during the emergency. But now that the emergency is over, you know, they need to take the stimulus away, right? But the mistake that they don't understand is they were wrong to do the stimulus in the beginning, because the minute they did it, they create an addiction that right. you can't withdraw it. Right. The minute you artificially interfere in the market and get it hooked on the equivalent of monetary heroin, then you can't take the heroin away. The mistake was getting the economy addicted to heroin in the first place. But once it's addicted, how these people think that you could just take away what the economy is addicted to, and you're not going to see, you know, some kind of withdrawal. So if the Federal Reserve were to take away the monetary supports, the whole economy would collapse. It doesn't matter about the emergency. That's irrelevant. The emergency now is that the economy is hooked on the drug of stimulus and you can't take it away. But of course, it's not a real economy. It's a phony economy. But no one wants to acknowledge that.
Yeah. And I use that example all the time, the monetary heroin. And I want to let you know that every time I reference that, I always give you credit.
So you're not going to Jeff Gunlock me. All right.
There you go.
But, you know, I'm not. I don't know that I'm the first person to make that comparison, because it's very easy, right? You're addicted to something. So I would forgive you, because I don't think I invented that one. But there are a few analogies I did come up with myself that Gunlock has a habit of passing off as his own.
Yeah, I know. I was listening to your podcast on that one in the gym the other day. I was getting a kick out of that. So everything that you're saying right now, if I'm the listener or the viewer, I'm thinking, man, this has to lead to long-term inflation, like 1970s. So, but the pushback there is, why is the dollar still at, call it 90, 91? And then why are, I know rates at the long end are going up, but if what you're talking about is going to come to fruition, I mean, rates should be at the long end, you know, on a 30-year should be 10%. So why are they down at 2%, and why is the dollar still at 90?
Well, because the Federal Reserve is in the market buying treasuries. I think the Federal Reserve now has, what is it, $5 trillion of treasuries on its balance sheet. And so the question is, where would interest rates be on treasuries if the Fed had not bought them all? Clearly, if the Fed is this huge buyer, then it's supporting the price. If you take that buyer away, the price of treasuries would have gone down, meaning the yields would have gone up. So you do have the Fed in there. Then you also have, I think, a lot of speculative money that is in the treasury bond market. Not, you know, basically because they see real long-term value in holding to maturity and clipping coupons, but because they're able to lever up and borrow money and at a cheaper rate and then buy the treasuries. You get tremendous margin on treasuries. I mean, you get massive leverage if you post treasuries as collateral. So you can create this trade with a lot of leverage. And so I think there's speculative demand in the market that is only there temporarily. I mean, at some point, the market's going to collapse. The same thing's going to happen with the dollar. You can say, well, why is the dollar index still at 90? Why hasn't it crashed? Well, you can keep saying that right up until the day that it does crash. But the momentum is building for the dollar to crash. I mean, you know, in a way, and again, I don't think I made this one up either, but I've been using it for a long time, but it reminds me of the Wile E. Coyote Roadrunner cartoons where you know, Wile E. Coyote runs off the edge of a cliff and he's just suspends in midair. And everything is fine until he looks down and notices where he's standing. And as soon as he realizes he's not on any ground, then he falls right into a puff of smoke. Yeah. So I think you've got a lot of people around the world that are still holding on to the dollar and they really haven't looked down yet. But when they do, you know, they're going to sell. The dollar's going to crash. I mean, there's no place for it to go but down.
Yeah. You know, whenever I think about the Fed adding additional demand to the long end of the curve right now, therefore, you know, bringing prices up, bringing yields down or artificially low, I go back and I look at a chart of QE1, QE2, and 3. And when they did that, the rates on the 10-year initially actually went up instead of down. So that's why just me personally, it's tough to reconcile how much the Fed is a part of the interest rate equation at the long end of the curve, because you know, you would have thought the rates would have plummeted during QE 1, 2, and 3, and they go the opposite direction. I guess because the market at that time expected that there would be inflation. And then when there wasn't, the rates went back down. But do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, I think that's true. And you initially start to see the government, the Fed, printing money to buy short-term treasuries. You know that that's inflationary. And so if they're not buying the, you know, the longer-term debt, then the yields are going to rise on that debt. People aren't going to want to hold it unless they can get a higher interest rate to compensate them for that increased risk. But you know, now you do have the Federal Reserve buying on the long end of the curve. In fact, remember Operation Twist? That was exactly what that was. That was about, we need to bring down longer term rates. So the Fed needs to start, you know, selling some of the short term and then using the money to buy long term. But you know, right now you still have a lot of misplaced confidence in the Fed, in the US economy, and therefore in the dollar. But I think as you know, more and more people are able to see the situation for what it is, understand that the Fed is you know all a bark and no bite when it comes to inflation fighting. In fact, they can't fight inflation. Inflation is the only policy tool, politically viable tool that they have. So they are deliberately creating inflation. They are deliberately debasing the value of the dollar. And when our creditors finally decide that they don't want to hold them anymore, then that's the end of it, right? Because then the dollar is going to fall precipitously and rates are going to move up. And it's going to be impossible for the Fed to stop it. You know, it's like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, you know, on Disney, where, you know, all the holes keep, you know, popping up and they got to try to get the water. But because eventually, as inflation starts to pick up, right, nobody is going to want to loan U.S. dollars at low interest rates. And so yields are going to be soaring on all dollar-denominated debt. Now, the Fed can't buy it all. What, are they going to buy all the munis? Are they going to buy all the corporates? You know, they're going to buy all the bonds? Because rates are going to start to rise. Because once you believe that inflation is going to be 5%, 10% a year, and it's not going to stop, are you going to loan somebody money at 2% or 3%? Why would you do that? You know?
Yeah. How much of inflation or sustained inflation, you know, because they're talking about this being transitory, but how much of sustained inflation do you believe is psychological?
Well, I don't think any of it is really psychological. I mean, the inflation is the expansion of the money supply.
Right.
I mean, that's
going
off the charts.
Yeah, right.
And I don't even think people really appreciate the degree to which prices are going to be rising. When they do, right, you know, that you're going to see it more. I mean, they are going to rush to the stores and buy everything that's on the shelves. It's going to happen. But I think we've had so many years where inflation has been there. I mean, prices have been going up on an annual basis. I mean, they don't come down, but they've gone up slowly. And so, you know, kind of like, you know, boiling a frog in oil, right? No one has really noticed the temperature coming up. But all of a sudden, you turn up the heat, you know, big time. people are going to notice and they're going to change their behavior.
Yeah.
And that's going to pick up the velocity of the money, right? On top of the increase in the supply of money. But, you know, I don't see any way that the Fed is going to turn off the presses. I mean, I just don't see it politically how it's going to happen. I mean, even when the Republicans were in charge, they couldn't cut government spending. You know, they kept increasing it. I mean, no one cares about the deficits. They all think that government is free if we pay for it with a printing press. And I don't even know that they're going to make the connection between all the money they're printing and prices going up. They'll start pointing fingers at other people. They'll start blaming Russia or China or speculators or OPEC or, you know, whatever. They're going to come up with all kind of scapegoats for why prices are rising, but they're never going to accept responsibility.
Right. So just going back a couple minutes, you were talking about how no one will want to lend money at the current interest rates because they know they're being paid back with devalued dollars. So what crossed my mind when you said that is that for unless the Fed is monetizing all this debt, usually in a normal economy, you've got the commercial banking system, which is creating the majority of the new money supply through additional lending, right? So if we get into this situation where none of the commercial banks want to lend, so they're lending less, that means that they are creating fewer dollars. So do you think that might add maybe a tailwind for the value of the dollar? But do you think it's enough to counterbalance the amount of new dollars that the government is producing by spending them into existence with the debt monetization through the Fed?
Well, that's exactly what's going to happen is because, see, when the dollar is weak, right, everybody wants to borrow dollars, right? Because it's a freebie. I'm going to borrow some dollars today, and I'm going to pay them back tomorrow when they have less value. So I get free money. Now, normally what would happen in a circumstance like that is interest rates would go up, right? And then, you know, that would make it more difficult to borrow dollars because now it would cost you more. And that's what would encourage people to lend. Yes, I'm losing money because the dollar is losing value, but I'm making up for it with this really high interest rate that I'm getting.
Right.
And so if I add the interest, you know, it'll subtract from the depreciation of the principal. But because the Federal Reserve does not want interest rates to go up, and you have all this demand for borrowing in dollars, the Fed comes in and supplies that demand. The Fed is what's funding all of this lending, right? The Fed buys these bonds to keep interest rates artificially low. And now in order to do that, they have to print money. The Fed has to create new dollars to make these loans that no one in the private sector wants to make. So you get more dollars. They just keep increasing the supply of dollars, which puts even more downward pressure on the price of dollars, which means more people want to borrow them. And of course, ultimately, what you want to do in inflation is you want to keep on borrowing dollars and buying real things with those dollars. Because if you're buying real things, as the value of the dollar goes down, the dollar price of those real things is going up. And if the interest rate on your loan is really, really low, if you buy real things that have income, like stocks that pay dividends, real estate that pays rents, it doesn't even cost you anything to service the debt. Right?
Right.
So inflation and artificial low interest rates just encourage debt, borrowing money, speculate in assets. The way you stop it is you let interest rates go up, and that crushes all the speculators because the asset prices crash, they default on the loans, they can't pay them back. But the Fed has already decided that that is never going to happen in America. The worst thing that can happen is deflation, right? Is falling asset prices, is debt defaults, is bankruptcies, right? That's the Great Depression. That's what they think of, or the financial crisis. So the government is always going to err on inflation. That's what Powell is saying right now. He's so worried about letting interest rates go up because the economy is so indebted. He's like, well, we're not going to try to be preemptive on inflation, which is the precedent, right? There's that old expression, never let the inflation genie out of the bottle. Right, because once it's out, it's really difficult to get it back in. So you're supposed to err on the side of caution. Hey, maybe there's going to be inflation. Let's not wait until we see the whites of its eyes. Let's fire now. Just, you know, that's what they're supposed to do. But Powell is like, he knows how addicted we are to cheap money. He doesn't want asset prices going down. He wants the government to have to spend more. He doesn't want the government to have to be fiscally responsible. So he's basically, you know, taking a chance that inflation is transitory, even though there's no reason to believe that it is, because I think Powell figures, you know what, if I have to fight inflation now, it's going to be a disaster. So let's just hope I never have to fight it. Even though by not fighting it now, he guarantees a bigger fight later. But what I'm saying and what the market still don't get is the Fed is not going to do it. Because when push comes to shove and they have to make the decision, they're not going to do it. Like I said, you're not going to pull the trigger on the handgun to cure your headache.
Right.
You're going to deal with the headache. So it's not going to be until there's a crisis. Now, I think when the dollar is in free fall, right, when we really have a currency crisis and a sovereign debt crisis, in that type of environment where like all hell is breaking loose, then maybe the Fed will be, okay, I got no choice. I got to pull the trigger here. But until that time, they're going to kick the can down the road. I mean, why deal with reality if they don't have to? And, you know, they've been lulled into a false sense of complacency. This has been going on for a long time, right? The Fed has been printing all this money, propping everything up, bailing everybody out. And as far as they're concerned, so far, so good, right? They're not looking at the enormity of the debt, the trade deficits, the budget deficits, the hollowing out of the economy. They're not looking at all the collateral damage that their policies have caused. All they care about is that the bubble keeps getting bigger. But you know, at some point it's going to pop, and then you know they're going to be forced to with a very difficult decision on, you know, do they stop the dollar from going to zero? Do they stop, you know, America from being Argentina or Zimbabwe or Weimar Republic? You know. But it's going to be very difficult to avoid that, because then they have to let interest rates go way up and then allow the chips to fall. They have to allow banks to fail, and they can't bail any of them out. They can't bail out anybody. They have to let the government default on its obligations and slash spending, because the only way they've been able to do the bailouts in the past is when they can print more money and cut rates. But if you're fighting inflation, how do you fight inflation? You withdraw money from circulation. You sell treasuries into the market, and you allow interest rates to go up. Well, if the Fed is doing that, well, then the government has no money for bailouts. The government needs a bailout, and there's nobody to bail them out.
Yeah, so let me back up here and just kind of walk through that counter balance that we were talking about before. So we've got maybe less lending initially with the commercial banking system, but we know the Fed is lending heavily in the financial economy. I mean, we just go back to March 2020, we saw them buying debt from corporates, you know, through the special purpose vehicle and whatnot. So maybe that was the counterbalance there, but maybe in the future, the Fed continues to backstop the loans that the commercial banks are making. So if it's not on the commercial banks' books, then who cares? Why not continue to lend? Because the Fed is going ahead and buying that paper. And then you get that kind of double whammy with the creation of additional dollars when you combine that with the deficit spending of the government with the Fed monetizing it. So I just wanted to wrap that up. But
I think maybe one point too, I think what happens with the banks is a lot of these banks, see, they can go directly to the Fed and they can just borrow right from the Fed at the Fed funds rate. And they can turn around and they can buy U.S. treasuries. They can buy mortgage-backed securities with that money. And they make the spread, right? So they're borrowing at 25 basis points and they're lending maybe at 150 basis points, right? And they make that spread all levered up. But the only way this can work is if the Fed basically assures all these banks, we're never going to let interest rates rise. Because if they let interest rates rise, the banks would all fail. because then the value of what they purchased, these loans, these long-term loans would collapse, right? If all of a sudden the banks were, if they were paying 25 basis points and earning 150 basis points, and now all of a sudden the Fed has to raise rates to fight inflation, and now rates are 5%, but the assets that they bought are still yielding 150 basis points, but now the cost is, you know, they go to huge losses. They may be not be able to withstand these losses. And so the Fed basically creates an unsustainable situation, and then it's forced to try to sustain it indefinitely. And so that's why, again, it's put itself into a box where fighting inflation is impossible because you can't do it without creating a, you know, an enormous financial crisis. And so instead, we're going to have a currency crisis.
Yeah, so I think we've definitely scared people enough about inflation. But just to add fuel to the fire, did you hear what Druckenmiller was talking about yesterday on CNBC, where he said he thought the dollar would lose reserve currency status in within 15 years?
Yeah, I heard him make that point. And then they were like, I think that somebody said, yo, you think it's good? The dollar is in imminent a risk of losing status. And he backtracked and said, no, it's not imminent, but I think it would happen, you know, over 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, he referenced, number one, he referenced that chart of retail spending, which I thought was unbelievable. I wanted to get your thoughts on that because, and I don't know if you recall the chart I'm referring to, but he showed where retail spending during the GFC went down, just plummeted, but it took 6 years to recover back up to the trend, where when we saw it plummet during March of 2020, because of the additional stimulus and unemployment benefits, it rebounded to the same level within 6 months. And now, because of all the other stimmy checks that we've been doing, you know, stimulus 2, 3, 4, who knows if we'll get infinity, retail spending has increased by 15% based on, or using 2019 as a baseline. And why that's such a staggering number, he pointed out that usually retail sales go up by 3% per annum. So since we're now 15% higher, the Fed and the government has pulled 5 years of retail spending into the present. And so, I mean, that just takes me right back to the monetary heroin. But can you explain to people how that distorts the economy and why that's so bad? Because Keynesians will say, oh, that's great. We've just increased demand.
Well, I mean, any idiot can increase demand. I mean, in fact, demand is infinite when you think about it. I mean, everybody wants everything. You know, the limiting factor is supply. You know, supply is what creates real demand. But if you don't have supply, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, the demand is meaningless because there's nothing to buy. And, you know, if you go back to 2008, when we had the financial crisis, in summer of 2008, the trade deficit was at an all-time record high. So Americans were spending a lot of money. We were spending it on imports, and we had a record trade deficit. When the financial crisis happened and Americans stopped spending or spent less, the trade deficit collapsed. I mean, it didn't go away. It's not like it turned into a surplus, but the deficits got much smaller. And then for a while even, we started to have a surplus in energy. We started producing a lot of energy, and so we were no longer net importers of energy. We were net exporters for a while. But if you look at what's happening now, the trade deficits are higher now during the pandemic than they were before. I mean, we blew up into all-time record high territory. Right. The opposite monetary policy. You see, the correct response to the pandemic, assuming that, you know, the government did what it did, which I think was a mistake, and I think the only reason that the states were so quick to shut down their economies was because of the moral hazard in knowing the government was going to bail everybody out. The Fed was going to supply all the money. I think if the states knew that if they shut down their businesses and forced their people not to go to their jobs, that there was going to be no money coming from the federal government, if they knew that that was the consequence, they would have done a cost-benefit analysis and decided, you know, it's not worth it. You know, we're not going to shut down the economy, and we would have been better off. Would we have had more COVID cases? Who knows? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But the real problem now isn't COVID. It's the government's cure, which is a far bigger deal. But the policy, the correct policy, when people are not working and they're not on their jobs, so they're not providing goods and services.
Right.
We need less money in the economy, not more. The money supply has to come down when people are providing fewer goods and services. Otherwise, prices are just going to go up for those goods and services. But not only did the money supply not come down, it skyrocketed. And what happened was the government gave all those unemployed people who were no longer earning any money, but they didn't earn it, right? And when you earn money as a reward for helping to produce goods and right. supply services. And because you help produce stuff, now you get to consume some of the stuff you help produce. But if you just sit at home on Netflix producing nothing, and then this check arrives in the mailbox, and now you go out and spend it, you didn't help produce anything to buy, but now you're out there spending stuff. So we have all this money, additional money, but we have less stuff to buy with the money. I mean, this is a...
But the key is, where's the stuff coming from? And you discuss this all the time.
Well, yes. So it's coming from abroad.
Right.
Right. So we have record trade deficits. You've got ships, backed up for miles and miles in lines, off the coasts. You got a shortage of containers to load stuff on. In fact, I talked about on my podcast that this year we set a record for the number of containers lost at sea, because they have to pile them so high that sometimes en route they fall off the boat, and so they don't make it across. But this is a massive economic imbalance, and a lot of the stuff we're buying, you got to wait 3 months, 6 months to get it delivered. Yeah. I mean, there's such a backlog of stuff that we're buying. In fact, one of the reasons probably that Americans still have so much stimulus money in the bank is because the stuff they want to buy isn't available. So they're waiting for them to be able to do it. And of course, also, they still can't travel as much. They still got these COVID restrictions. But this money is burning a hole in their pockets. And meanwhile, too, a lot of Americans who don't have jobs but now earn more money not working, mm-hmm. a lot of these guys are not paying their rent. And they're not paying the interest on their student loans or the principal, because the government declared a moratorium on all that. And so they've got money to spend on everything. And, where are the landlords getting money if the tenants aren't paying rent? Well, a lot of cases, the government is providing the landlords with their money. Right. And what about lenders? If you made a student loan and the government guarantees that loan, and now the government says, hey, you student, you don't have to make your loan payments, the government has to make them, because the government guaranteed them. Now, obviously, if it's a government loan, well, the government doesn't have to make the payments because the government was the lender. But now the government's not getting the money that it was supposed to get. So the deficits are skyrocketing, money printing. This is going off the charts. The question is, when are our trading partners going to really start jacking up their prices even more than they already have?
Before you go into that, I want to connect the dots real quick here. So when you're talking about all those goods coming in that we are consuming and we're not producing ourselves, I want to point out to people that if those goods are coming in from abroad, that means dollars, green pieces of paper, are going out. So the bigger our trade deficit, the more goods we're importing, the more dollars are going out to foreigners and they're holding. And this brings us to the point you're making.
Yeah, we're exporting our inflation. Now, what happens is foreigners, to the extent that they're willing to invest those dollars in our financial assets, bonds, stocks, then it doesn't come back into the economy bidding up consumer prices. But if they lose confidence in financial assets, which I think they will, I think we've had a long period of outperformance in the U.S. stock market. And so a lot of foreigners were willing to take those dollars and, buy Amazon stock or, whatever. And I don't think they're going to be doing that. I mean, if you haven't been paying attention, there is a rotation that's in its infancy, but it's got a long way to go. And we're rotating out of big tech momentum into mm-hmm. real value, dividend-paying stocks, and that doesn't favor the U.S. market. It was the growth stocks that didn't have income and didn't pay dividends. That's what dominates the U.S. market. So we have some value stocks, but there are much better value stocks in Europe, in Asia, than there are in the United States. But I also think the rotation is going to be out of U.S. into foreign stocks, out of developed markets into emerging markets, and out of dollars into other currencies and commodities. So then when you have all these foreign exporters that are earning these dollars, they don't want to invest in U.S. stocks and bonds. They want to get rid of those dollars to do something else. And so now they're going to start coming back. And they're going to come back to buy stuff. Buy what? What are we making? Right? So, they start buying used stuff. One of the things I think they're going to buy a lot of is our used cars. That's one of the reasons that the used car prices could go way up, because a lot of people in China may decide, you know, I've been riding my bicycle for a long time. I think I'll buy a car. Hey, there's a lot of cars in America. Let me buy one of them. You're right. And as the dollar is plunging, those cars are getting really cheap for the Chinese if their currency is going up, which is why I've been joking for a long time that we're going to send the Chinese our cars and they're going to send us their bicycles.
but I want to
be able to afford gas anyway, so
yeah, I want to connect some more dots for the viewers and the listeners there, because you talked about all of those green pieces of paper. The foreigners have those, that's what they're trading the stuff that they're producing for. But it gets to a point where they're like, okay, I don't really want any dollar denominated assets anymore. And Druckenmiller made this point as well when he brought up the capital account. And he referenced back to 2020, and he saw in all his 40 years of managing money, he had never seen what happened back in, I think, March or April of 2020. And that's when you had a global crisis, but foreigners didn't buy treasuries on net balance. And so you saw the capital account. Actually, you know, the foreigners were bringing in a lot of those dollars to buy treasuries, and all of a sudden they stopped buying those treasuries. And his point is they went into growth stocks, but dovetailing on what you just said, if interest rates are going up, then you're seeing rotation from growth to value. Those foreigners can get value stocks, better value stocks outside of the United States. So those dollars aren't coming back into the U.S. His point was twofold. Number one, there's going to be no buyers for treasuries other than the Fed, but to a greater extent than we're seeing right now. And there's going to be more dollars that are staying outside of the United States, circulating in the global economy, putting downward pressure on the dollar against other currencies and DXY. That's how he kind of came to that conclusion, that 15-year time frame.
Yeah, well, I don't know if we've got 15 years, because the minute people, you know, there's a consensus that builds that the dollar is going down, people aren't going to just ride it down for 15 years. They're just going to get out now. It's going to become a race to get out, and, you know, it's going to collapse quickly. But that the good point, or the, you know, the point we're making here, or I think you're making, is that historically, at least, you know, in the recent past, one of the ways that we've been able to cushion the blow of any kind of downturn is that the dollar has always been the safe haven of choice.
Right.
Despite the fact that I think the dollar is in worse shape than a lot of the currencies that people are selling to buy the dollar as a safe haven, a lot of it is psychology. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If people just believe the dollar is a safe haven and they almost just buy it, you know, kind of like Pavlovian, you know, dog, it's like there's a problem and the computer algorithms, oh, buy the dollar, right? That's what that's, you know, how they've been programmed. If there's a problem, you buy the dollar. I mean, in fact, I thought one of the most ridiculous illustrations of this, I remember, and I forget when it was, what year it was, but Standard & Poor's downgraded U.S. Treasuries. And that, you know, they did it once and they've never done it again, right? Because they got taken to the woodshed by the government. Yeah. But they downgraded U.S. Treasuries, and that created like a shock, like the stock market. Oh, my God, they just downgraded U.S. Treasuries. And you know what happened? People bought U.S. Treasuries on the downgrade, because U.S. Treasuries became a safe haven from U.S. Treasuries. That's how crazy it was. Oh, my God, they just downgraded U.S. Treasuries. I better buy more of them, because this is a real, you know, dangerous thing. So every time we've had a problem, people have wanted to loan us more money. And that's mitigated the downturn, because now our interest rates go down so we can borrow cheaper. The dollar goes up. We get to buy things for less money. So everybody sending money to the U.S. kind of helped support the U.S. economy and make it look like it was actually stronger, even though the only reason it was stronger was because so many people were loaning us money, even though it's impossible to pay any of it back. Mm-hmm. But if what Druckenmiller is observing is correct, in that we're no longer looked at as the safe haven, and so people are not running to the dollar when they sense problems, they're running from the dollar.
Right.
And if they're running from the dollar, what are they running towards? You know, obviously some people ran towards crypto, And I think they're going to, you know, have a lot of problem. But the obvious destination is you go to other currencies, right? You go to euros or yen or, you know, smaller currencies that have even better, macroeconomic, characteristics than those countries. But also you go to gold, you go to silver, right? You go to real money that mm-hmm. central banks can't print, or you go to real assets. You go to real estate, income producing property. You go to stocks, income producing, dividend paying stocks, real things, once you start to see that there's inflation, that there's a risk, but you stop buying US dollars or right. US treasuries, because the US treasury is only as good as the dollar, right? So you can't say, well, I'm bullish on treasuries, but I'm bearish on the dollar. The dollar is treasuries are the dollar.
Right.
They're just dollars long in the future, right? And that's even less valuable than dollars today. If you think dollars are going to lose value, then what would you rather have, a dollar today or a dollar in 30 years? I mean, the dollar in 30 years is worth a lot less than a dollar today. So if you're bearish on the dollar, then you have to be bearish on treasuries. You know, even if the treasury price doesn't go down, the real value is going down because all you're getting for your treasuries are dollars. Yeah. And so the key is, what can you buy with those dollars? And I think the most sensitive holders are foreign, because they immediately see the loss, right? Because they're referencing their accounts in their local currency.
Yeah, and their expenses are in their local currency.
Right, and so they're the most sensitive. So they're likely to start dumping dollars first. But then Americans are going to start to see the same thing when the dollars they're earning, every time they go to spend their paycheck, they buy less and less stuff,
right?
They're going to want to figure out, hey, I'm going to spend every nickel I make, but if I have something left over, where am I going to put it? I can't just hold it in cash, so I'm going to just go buy more stuff and fill up my closets or fill up my basement, or maybe I'll quickly go and buy some gold or buy some silver, buy something that's going to hold its value, so that if I want to buy something in the future, I'll be able to do it.
Do you think we'll get a central bank digital currency?
Well, it seems inevitable that digital currencies are coming. I mean, most of the money that the central banks create is already digital.
Yeah, but when we all have an account with the Fed and, it all goes through the Fed instead of the commercial banking system.
Well, I don't know that you would eliminate the commercial banking system if you went to a digital currency. Because most of the money that I have on deposit at a bank is digital. They don't have the cash sitting in a vault. So it's just an entry on their books. But I think what happens when you eliminate cash, you now give the U.S. government much more control over the citizenry. Mm-hmm. And they also know exactly what we're doing. I mean, they already pretty much know what you're doing, right? Because they can get your bank statements. They can get your credit card records. So they can figure out where you're spending your money. But they don't know what you're doing with your cash. So to the extent that you have some cash, you can still affect some transactions in private. But when the government eliminates cash, well, then you can't do anything in private. I mean, unless you go outside the monetary system and you start, transacting in silver coins or something like that. But the government has a lot more control over you. And I don't like that. I mean, people should be fearful of giving the government all that control over our lives and the loss of privacy, where the government knows every single thing that you do.
Right.
And then they have more power to micromanage your behavior, where they can, you have money here and, we're going to take it away from you. They can impose negative interest rates or all kinds of things much easier. Because, what were they doing when they started to do negative interest rates in Europe? People were just taking the money out of the bank and putting it in their mattress, right? But if you can't do that, if you have to leave it at the bank, then you have no way to get out of the negative interest other than just spending the money.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
All right, that's kind of their dream scenario, I think. All right, Peter, I know we're running short on time, so I want to ask you what you think the dollar end game actually is. Because I hear you talking all the time about the dollar's going to crash, it's going lower, the foreigners are going to, you know, treat their dollars like a hot potato and all these things. And I totally understand that. But what is the detail of how it actually plays out? I mean, do you think that we'll get to a point where they'll back a digital dollar, let's say, with gold? And if so, how would they have to reprice gold? How would that actually work logistically? Have you given that any thought?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I do think that ultimately all roads lead back to gold. You know, I mean, gold is the anchor of the monetary system. You know, we've kind of drifted because, you know, we haven't had that anchor for a while. I mean, but we're going to go back to it. I mean, history, you know, is replete with examples of nations that have tried a fiat system and it's never succeeded. I mean, the difference between the most recent experiment is that it's worldwide. It's not just one nation trying it. It's the whole world that tried it. Right. And it really was the U.S. that got everybody to do it. And so it's kind of our fault. But I think we're going to have a currency crisis. And I don't know of any way to reinstill confidence other than with real money. So I think that's where we're headed. You know, a lot of people, too, they'll criticize me because they'll say, hey, Peter thinks the dollar is so bad. But, you know, what about the euro? What about the yen? I mean, everybody is printing too much money. I mean, we're the cleanest dirty shirt in the hamper. You know, why are you so negative on the dollar, yet, you know, you're not worried about the euro or you're not worried about the yen? I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, there's no problems in these other countries. There are a lot of problems. We're talking about relative problems, not, yes. I mean, everybody is doing bad. I mean, so, you know, if I wasn't grading on a curve, everybody would get an F, right? But if you're going to put a curve in there, the U.S. is in much worse shape. All you have to do is look at the trade picture. Right. Who is the big trade debtor? Right? Who's running these massive trade deficits? Well, it's America. Right? So if America is running these deficits, we don't run the deficits with ourselves. Somebody is generating the surpluses.
Yeah, Japan and Europe.
Yeah. Somebody is producing all the stuff that we're consuming. Right? Somebody is lending all the money that we're borrowing, right? And so those countries that have been producing and under-consuming, they're going to fare better than the United States. America generates the biggest windfall from the current monetary system, right? We are the issuer of the reserve currency, so we get that privilege. We get to consume without producing. And, you know, consuming without producing is a lot easier than producing without consuming. You know, we don't have to deal with factories. We don't have to deal with pollution. We just get all this stuff that just shows up and we just buy it all. And so if you believe that we're going to have a global reset, right? Well, what country is going to suffer the most? Well, the country that benefited the most from the old status quo, it's the U.S., it's the American standard of living that is going to suffer. See, because what's going to happen if we have to resolve these imbalances? So all of our trading partners, right, instead of producing stuff and sending it to America, they'll produce stuff and consume it themselves. So how are they worse off? They don't get as many dollars, but they get a lot more stuff. They get a lot more goods that can improve the quality of their lives, right, because they have more consumer goods. On the other hand, what happens to America, right? We don't get all the goods coming in, but we can keep printing dollars. But what good are those dollars if we'd have nothing to buy? were good when we can spend them on stuff made in China, but we can only spend them on stuff made here. We're not making any stuff. So it's America that had the most, that benefited the most from this system. It's America that's going to suffer the most when it collapses. But also, you have to start thinking about what is the policy response going to be to a crash in the dollar, right? To massive inflation, big unemployment, this whole economic collapse. What is the U.S. government going to do? Well, if you look at what we've done in the past, you're not going to be very optimistic on what we're going to do in the future. It's going to be, oh my God, capitalism really sucks, and this proves it. Right. You know, we need more government. We need, you know, bigger government. We need to, you know, more control, more regulation. And so that's a very dangerous, you know, course that we're going to take. And so that's going to debase the dollar even more. And I keep looking at the fact that America has been really a drag on the global economy, because the world has been required to support America. That's the price it's paid for the dollar as the reserve currency. The rest of the world has to produce enough to sustain Americans who are not producing. So we're this giant burden that the world has to bear. They have to consume less so that we can consume more. They can't use all their savings for themselves. They've got to loan it to us, and we never pay it back. So the way I look at it, when this whole arrangement comes to an end and the world is no longer burdened with the responsibility of carrying the U.S. on its back, then it's a boom. I mean, the only thing that you can maybe say that we've been providing to the world is defense, right? Because we don't bill everybody for their share of our defense budget. Yeah. But the question in my mind is America making the world safer with all this money, or is it making it less safe? You know, are we kind of like the mafia that, you know, gets collection money to, you know, from the storekeepers to protect them from us? That, hey, if you don't pay us this money, we're going to trash your store.
Right. I mean,
if America wasn't out there interfering in so many countries, maybe the world would be a safer place, and maybe we wouldn't need a big military. I don't know. I mean, even if you X out, you know, even if we build everybody for a reasonable share of our defense budget, it would pale in comparison to the subsidies that they're providing us for consumption.
Yeah, right. And so
the world is going to benefit, and America is going to suffer. And so on a relative basis, I do believe that every currency on the planet Earth is going to lose purchasing power in terms of gold, right? So I believe that gold will go up in terms of every currency. I just believe that it'll go up more in terms of dollars than it will in most other currencies.
So do you think we'll go back to a global gold standard?
Well, again, I think eventually we have to, because I think, let's say we have a real dollar crisis where the dollar just collapses, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it doesn't go to zero, but you know, the dollar index, which is right now we talk about, it's around 90.
Right.
You know, what if it goes to 40 or 30 or lower? Right.
Quickly. I mean, I think it's a matter of how fast it goes there too, as far as confidence.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's going to go there. I mean, I think the road down to 70 could be kind of orderly and slow and may take a year or two, but the move from 70 to 40 could happen in weeks. Right. Yeah. I mean, it confidence goes. But if there's a big loss of confidence in the dollar, you know, what does that say about the euro? What does that say about the yen or any of these other currencies? Because really, what's the difference? I mean, they're all paper. They're all based on confidence. Yes. I mean, you may have a better fiscal situation in those countries. But hey, once upon a time, America was the world's biggest exporter. We were the world's biggest creditor nation. And look what happened to the dollar. So if the dollar could crash, right, the almighty invincible dollar, if the risk-free asset, U.S. Treasuries, right, is like a junk bond and crashing, well, then what does that say about the sovereign debt of any nation? Right. So I think a dollar crisis ultimately could spark a worldwide currency crisis.
Systemic currency, right.
And so... how do you reinstill confidence? How do you reassure your citizens that if they save your currency, it's not going to crash like the dollar did. You can't just, you know, make promises, you know, because what good are promises? What good are words? What you need to do is you need to say, hey, this currency is tied to gold, and this is the exchange rate. This is the rate. And so we guarantee that this paper is worth this much gold. And right. In fact, you go back to the original definition of a dollar, the dollar was a weight of gold. That's what it was. The dollar was defined by a particular number of grams of gold. So mm-hmm. just like, you know, what's a foot? Well, a foot is 12 inches. That's what makes a foot. You have, if you have 12 inches, you got a foot. If you got 11 inches, you're not a foot, right? If I say, how tall are you? And you say 6 feet, you're only 6 feet if you're measuring with rulers that have 12 inches in each one to be 6 feet, right? If you have a 10-inch ruler, I mean, you know, it's not going to work. So gold, the dollar, was a certain weight of gold. If you didn't have enough gold, you didn't have a dollar. You had to have all the gold. That's why when they made the coins and they minted them and they put the mill marks around them, it was to prevent people from scraping off some of the gold. Because if you scraped off the gold, it would no longer be a dollar because it wouldn't have enough gold there.
Right.
And so that's what you have to do. You have to bring money back to a weight of something real. Right? Money has to be real. That's why cryptocurrencies will never be money, because they're not real. They don't have any actual value in the real world. You can't do anything with it. You don't use it for anything. But gold has real value. It has real use. And that value will be stored over time. So if I earn some gold today, I know that if I don't spend it today, I can spend it tomorrow, because that gold's not going anywhere. It's not going to lose any of its properties over time. It's going to stay exactly the way it is for eternity. And whatever I can do with gold today, somebody else can do with it in 100 years. So right. it stores its value.
So you don't like the argument that we'll go into an SDR, that the IMF will just swoop in when we have this global fiat currency crisis and say, okay, here's SDRs, we're good to go, off to the races.
Yeah, that seems like a stretch. I mean, the dollar just crashed, and then some other bankers are going to say, okay, take this. And meanwhile, what backs FDRs? Dollars,
nothing.
That's the main reserve behind
FDR. Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, the dollar is crashing. So here's an FDR that's backed by dollars. And so what are they going to say? Okay, now it's not backed by dollars. It's backed by the euro. You know, what good is that? Or it's backed by the yen. So there is no way. This is all just a dream scenario that somehow we're going to get on this global fiat system where it's all, you know, special drawing rights created out of thin air by the IMF.
Right.
No, I mean, if there's a loss of confidence in paper, right, people are going to want to own something real. That's you know, that's the way it's always worked. You know, you got all these people trying to reinvent the wheel with cryptocurrency. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. The wheel still works. And when it comes to money, gold is the wheel, right?
Yeah.
And it's going to work. You know, all this fool's gold, you know, in the form of Bitcoin and everything else, you know, they've had alchemists for centuries trying to con people into believing that they could create gold out of nothing. You can't do it. You can't defy the laws of physics.
Well, on the topic of gold, Peter, and I'll let you go, have you ever seen a chart of the Reichmark relative to gold right before the hyperinflation of Weimar Germany?
Yeah, well, it's the same chart relative to the dollar, because the dollar was gold back then. But
the point I'm trying to make there for people who haven't seen that chart from we think that this hyperinflation was just kind of this progressive thing and gradual, then boom, it just took off. But from 19, so the main hyperinflation in Germany was 1923, but from 1920 to 1922 and a half, the Reichsmark, their currency, actually appreciated in value against gold. And then 6 months later, a year later, it's toilet paper.
Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of it is just the psychology.
Yeah.
And, you know, because the value of a fiat currency derives 100% from the confidence that people have in it. That's the same thing with a cryptocurrency. It's, do people believe in it, right? And if people stop believing in it, well, the whole thing implodes, and it happens very quickly. And, you know, if it could happen that quickly in, you know, Germany, imagine how much quicker it can happen now, because they didn't have the internet back then. You know, information didn't flow as quickly. They didn't even really have telephones. I mean, it was just word of mouth, right? You had to meet somebody, you know, and you had to find out. So inflammation went very slowly, and it certainly probably took a long time for the information to get from Germany all the way across the Atlantic to the United States, right? You know, so, but now something starts to happen to the dollar. The whole world knows about it instantaneously at the same time. So information is going to flow much quicker, which means the dollar can implode much quicker, you know, right. once it really starts to happen. And, yeah, you know, initially, too, how do people going to react to this? Because they've never seen it. I mean, let's say a lot of these traders, they come in the morning and they see the dollar is down like 5%, like a move like they've never seen.
Mm-hmm.
Their inclination is, oh, let me buy this. Whoa, I'm going to buy this dip, right? I'm going to buy. And then it goes down another 5% or, I mean, 10%. And then people start getting wiped out and all the margin calls. I mean, then it's just a panic liquidation. I mean, let me get the hell out. Right. Because we haven't seen this. I mean, you could look at other currencies and how quickly. Look at what's happened recently with the Turkish lira. I mean, look how quickly. And the fundamentals in Turkey, believe it or not, were a lot better than they are in the United States. As far as, you know, their trade balance and budget deficits. I mean, we're a bigger Turkey than Turkey. Look how quickly that currency went down. So look, it can happen even more in the United. Everybody thinks, you know, we're immune to these laws, you know, because we're so big. No, the laws still apply, right? I mean, gravity still applies to the United States. Just because we're big doesn't mean the laws of physics don't apply. The laws of economics apply too. You know, we've just been able to get away with it longer because of our size. You know, the world has been willing to carry us. They weren't willing to give Turkey the benefit of the doubt, right? But with America, yes, you know, and of course we have a good reputation that we've been living off of because we were this rich, powerful industrial country that led the world in freedom and all that. And so, you know, we had a lot of reputation that, you know, we were able to live on for a long time.
Reputation of low taxes, rule of law, and things like this, and business friendly, and we're all losing that now as well.
Yeah. Everything that once made America exceptional, you know, is all under attack now as being racist or whatever it is.
Right.
And so once that mystique is gone, you know, it's going to happen quickly. And, you know, that's why I've always been telling people, look, I don't care if you protect yourself early because you can't do it late. And we're never going to do it just in time, right? Nobody is smart enough to know exactly the moment that everything's going to collapse and then prepare yourself like right before. Can't be done. But because I know when it happens, it's going to be quick and it's going to be, you know, tremendous and it's going to be fatal for a lot of investors, I want to be prepared in advance, right? And I am so convinced that I'm right, I'm willing to ride it out, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter to me how early I am if I know that I'm right. And I'm just going to position myself that when it happens, I'm prepared. I'm not blindsided. Now, you know, we have had a lot of events that blindsided people, like the financial crisis of 2008. And the only reason a lot of the people who weren't prepared for that didn't get wiped out was because the government bailed them out. Well, in the ultimate crisis, like I said, there are no government bailouts. So you get this wrong, it's done. You don't get a do-over, right? Like we did with the financial crisis. So, you know, you got to divest of dollars. You got to own these foreign stocks. You got to own commodities, gold and silver. And you know, you look back at the performance of my portfolios, even during the last 10 years, which was very challenging for my strategy, we still made money. It's not like we lost money. We could have made more money in the NASDAQ, but that's with the benefit of hindsight. Mm. But you go back to my strategy from 2000 to 2010, we crushed the NASDAQ during those 10 years. I mean, close, we killed the S&P. So there are periods of time where the dollar is weak and commodities, emerging markets are strong. So you have these cycles. But at the end of the day, when the dollar crashes, these stocks are going to go ballistic. And I just want to make sure that I own them when that happens. And even though I was surprised that we were able to kick the can down the road for a decade, It's not like I got wiped out during that decade. I am in fantastic position personally. I think my clients are in fantastic position to make a killing off the events that are about to transpire. Whereas I think a lot of other people who are happy because they got a big mountain of paper profits, they're going to wake up to a rude reality when those paper profits are either gone or are meaningless because the paper doesn't buy anything.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, that's a perfect segue into letting people know how they can invest in your strategy, how you can help them do that. So let's give Euro-Pacific Asset Management. I see the logo right in the back there. Let's give it a plug. Where can people go to contact you?
I'm glad that you asked that question. Very astute. But yes, Euro-Pacific Asset Management, we're all here in Puerto Rico. My whole team lives in Puerto Rico, the portfolio managers. And we manage portfolios. And so you can have a separately managed account where, you know, you have an account. It's just your account. And it's in individual stocks, and we manage it for you on a fee basis. And it's a global portfolio, and we're buying stocks all around the world that basically will do well, you know, especially when my thesis plays out about a weak dollar. So we have international value stocks. We're collecting good dividends in foreign currencies. We have a lot of exposure to resources that are going to do particularly well in a global inflationary environment. So you can have an account with me in individual stocks. We also manage mutual funds. I have five funds in the family that you can buy directly from Euro-Pacific Asset Management, or you can buy them at Schwab, Fidelity, you know, Ameritrade, you know, any of these discount brokers. I'm on almost every platform. You can buy the funds there. You can also get into wrap accounts where I will manage a portfolio of my mutual funds for you. So we put you in the funds, but then we will be able to rotate, you know, to different funds if there's a reason to reallocate among those funds. But again, you know, these funds, I think, will continue to do well even if we don't get a dollar crash. But if we do get a dollar crash, that's when they're going to do exceptionally well. And I think that dollar crash is obviously going to happen a lot sooner than I once thought. Because, you know, there's a limit to how long we can delay this. Because every time we delay it, we make the problem worse. And the debt bubble gets bigger. And so the bigger the problem, the more debt is required to take on to postpone the consequences. But just the rule of numbers, at some point, it is impossible to make that bubble that much bigger without popping it. So I think we're very close. So people can contact me directly at Euro-Pacific Funds, europacfunds.com, or Euro-Pacific Capital website, which is europac.com, and talk with one of my representatives, you know, get an account set up, or, you know, you could do it yourself by, you know, just going to epacfunds.com. You can buy my mutual funds right off my website.
And you got guys like Druckenmiller that are seeing things the exact same way that you're seeing them right now. So
yeah,
I think
there are a lot of smart people.
He's a smart dude. He's a real smart dude.
There are a lot of smart people that are now saying, yeah, you need to get out of growth into value. You need to get out of the U.S. and have more exposure internationally. You got to look more towards emerging markets. And you got to take a look at the commodity space in industrial materials, agriculture, oil and gas. So a lot of people are now coming to the conclusion that I came to a long time ago, and now they're moving into the assets that I already own. But I think these guys are doing the right thing. They just don't really appreciate how right it is. They have no idea just how much they're going to make or how big the returns are, because I don't think they see the degree of the problem, right?
Yeah, right.
Or how, and maybe some of them do, but they're reluctant to publicly admit it. Right, because they don't want to be labeled, you know, a gloom and doom kook like me, right? They're too interested in maintaining their, you know, their mainstream credibility. So, you know, they don't want to, you know, risk going out on that limb and sounding like a Peter Schiff, even if a lot of these guys are sounding like Peter Schiff.
Even if they use a lot of your examples, right?
Yes,
or
even
analogies.
Even if they specifically use my analogy. But yeah, you know, it's comforting to see other smart people agreeing with me. Now, I don't want everybody to agree with me. That would be uncomfortable. You know, right. I like to be in the minority, and it really makes me happy to hear all these idiots coming on CNBC every day with a bunch of nonsense. You know, so I'm glad, you know, that they keep recommending. In fact, I put it on a tweet yesterday. I think, you know, the return that you can expect on an asset is inversely proportional to the amount of positive coverage the asset gets on CNBC. So basically, you want to buy something that they don't even discuss. It's not even on their screens, right? They don't even know about it. But the stuff they keep pumping every day, like Bitcoin or, you know, Kathy Wood, you know, her ARK Innovation Fund. I mean, buy it. I mean,
Dogecoin. They're talking about Dogecoin now all the time,
look,
too.
Yeah, anything they're talking about, you know, the party's over. By the time they're talking about it, you need to be selling it. So I'm glad they're not talking about the stuff that I'm buying. I mean, they maybe once in a while they'll have somebody come on and, you know, they'll say this stuff, but that's for like, you know, 2% of their day. The other 98% of it is a bunch of nonsense. And so that's good. That gives me comfort. Because by the time, you know, they're fully on board with my strategy, it may be time to get out of that strategy. And I'm hopeful. Like, I hope that at some point I could tell people, yeah, sell your foreign stocks and buy American stocks. Sell your gold and, you know, and get, I would love to be able to do that. Because the only reason I would be able to do that is if we had swallowed the medicine and made the necessary reforms to create a viable economy again. And as an American citizen, as the father of three, nothing would make me happier than for our country to do the right thing so that it can succeed and prosper so that my children can grow up as Americans, as opposed to having to get new passports and becoming citizens of some other country, which is always a risk that I'm worried about.
Well, hopefully we'll build back on that solid foundation soon, Peter. I sincerely appreciate your time.
Yeah, in the meantime, people can listen to my podcast at shiftradio.com or on my YouTube channel. I'm putting out a lot of content. You're putting out a lot of good content. And, you know, there's a few other, you know, we're not the only ones. There's other people out there. But, you know, we're still in the minority. But at least we're there. And at least the internet exists. And you don't have the big gatekeepers, although they're trying now. Where, you know, they're trying to put pressure on big companies to kind of silence us if they don't agree with what we're saying. But at least right now we're saying it and people are able to listen to it because they've got the internet. So
and I'm even doing live conferences where people can meet people like you and awesome thinkers. And I'm trying, you see me kind of giving a subtle hint here, guys. If you want to see Peter at the next Rebel Capitalist live show, definitely tell him in the comments of his videos because I'm trying to.
Yeah, I haven't been going to conferences. I know it's because, you know, part of it's not so much the fear for COVID. I've just thought that the conferences wouldn't be that well attended because other people wouldn't want to go either.
No, so mine's sold out. Yeah, we sold out for June, and I can promise you we're going to have a sellout in January as well.
Yeah, well, January in Florida is probably better than June. June is pretty nice weather everywhere. But yeah, as I said, I'm going to be up in Connecticut for a little bit in June. So I didn't really have that much time to fly down. But yeah, maybe January, because I'm supposed to go to my first conference in New Orleans in October, because I haven't been going to conferences.
Well, you know what? They just asked me to go to that and speak. I'll be there as well speaking. I think your boy Adrian Day is going to be there, isn't he?
Yeah, Adrian is always there. I mean, there's a lot of great people at that conference. I think I'm supposed
to do a panel with him.
And New Orleans is a fantastic city. I mean, I love going there. So it's just a fun time. And so, yeah, probably a bunch of us will share a plane and fly over there. Because they don't have any direct commercial flights to New Orleans. So it's much better to fly private.
All right. Well, the bottom line is I'll see you there, buddy. I'll see you there in October.
Yeah, and so that should be that's the first one I agreed to do. Everything else I've been saying no, I haven't been doing them. So that will be my first return to the public since the COVID lockdown. And I am vaccinated now too, so finally.
All right. Well, then I feel safe getting a beer with you.
You got the vaccine?
No. I'm not going to go down that path, but we'll talk about that later. All right, Peter, have a good one, buddy.
All right, take care.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.